Eric Hobsbawm, it seems to me the most beguiling line in your new book is the reflection that at the incredible speed of change now, we don't know, you don't know where we're going.
No, we don't. In the first place, of course, the pace of history, pace of social change, has been accelerating and keeps on accelerating to such an extent that we simply don't know where where it's going to be moving next. What we do know is that the results are, first of all, unprecedented, and secondly, in some ways, uncontrollable. Unprecedented, if you think, for instance, that the internet, for practical purposes, is no more than 15 years old. And the transformation in those 15 years, well, I don't have to tell you, draw you a diagram on this. The uncontrollable effects, well, there's above all the environment. The way in which the basic sources for energy on which we rely, the basic sources of raw material, are being used up. And the extent to which they can be replaced, and what happens if they don't get replaced, that's one thing. But secondly, we don't know where we're going because we are in a period of rapid transition between, you might say, two types of world order. The European, North American, or if you like, North Atlantic world order, which basically dominated until the end of the 20th century, and the future order, which I think may well show a reversion of the center of civilization, of economics, possibly even of culture, to the traditional centers of civilization in Asia, between Asia and the Middle East. So, prediction, I think, is a monk's game.
You were born in 1917 into a world of empires that have all crashed or dissolved by now, except perhaps the United States. Some people miss them. What is your view of the future of hegemony, of dominion, and especially the American version?
I think there's no doubt that some people miss empires. in the short run, certainly. There may be a few empires which are missed in the longer run, for instance, the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire. My guess is that if anybody is old enough to have survived from the 1920s or thereabouts in places like Krakow or Slovenia or the western part of Yugoslavia, Bosnia or Romania, they would still feel a bit sentimental about the days of the old Emperor Francis Joseph. But that's gone. It's gone for good. hegemony is a different matter. There hasn't been much hegemony. There's been, if you like, American hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. Europe has never been under hegemonic control for more than a decade or two, at best, during wars.
Since when? I mean,
Since
Napoleon, since Rome?
Well, Napoleon didn't last very long. Since Rome, if you like. If you like, Europe has been, which is a plural entity, has been run for 200 years, reasonably effectively, except for occasional breakdown, by a sort of conjunction of five or six important powers, which actually, over the 19th century, mostly also ran a good deal of the world and certainly conquered it. But you can't say that there's a hegemony of any single country, and no country has actually tried it except the United States quite recently.
It is still acutely mysterious to me that Tony Blair's England, torn between Europe and its transatlantic friend, followed George Bush and the United States into what feels now like an imperial adventure, misadventure in Iraq. What does that war mean for the United Kingdom, for the U.S., for the future of hegemony?
The interesting thing about the Iraq war is that unlike the first Gulf War, unlike even the first American intervention after 9/11 in Afghanistan, it has no common support at all. Overwhelmingly, most countries were against it, and the others were skeptical, with the single exception of Great Britain. Great Britain, I think, has been tied to the United States ever since, I think, its own status as a nuclear power became dependent on, effectively, the American supplies. Hmm. And ever since its status as an international power became dependent effectively on access to American technical intelligence. And I think that's one major reason why they felt they couldn't possibly break. That doesn't explain why we had to rush into it, devote an enormous amount of our energies and military force. After all...
And reputation.
And reputation. After all, in the 1970s, when L.B. Johnson asked our Prime Minister Wilson to send the Black Watch to Vietnam, he refused to do it very quietly. He kept on repeating how totally in favor he was with the Americans, but he didn't do anything. Unlike Blair, Blair rushed in because I think he loved the idea of being, as it were, a deputy imperial power. Hmm. And let's make no mistake about it, he also thought somehow or other there needed to be Western force which somehow or other controlled the disorder in the world, which is no longer controllable by anybody in the old 19th and imperial ways. Hmm. That's the thing to remember. Not anymore.
And why not?
Well, the fact is you've got to establish it. I mean, the Iraq War has shown it, but not only the Iraq War. Things like Darfur and so on, where nowadays you say you need at least 26,000 troops simply to watch over the whole thing. The basic fact is that the populations of the world are no longer prepared to accept power as something that is authentic and authoritative. Imperialism in the old days was based on the assumption that quite small groups of people armed with high tech could establish themselves and be accepted, like it or not, by millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, partly because power is there and people, poor people have lived under power all the time. One or two exceptions, places like Afghanistan and Kurdistan, where nobody liked power, states or any kind of thing, and never has and doesn't do it now. But there was that, and at the same time also there was the possibility of making alliances with locals who wanted modernization, which in those days meant westernization. But it doesn't mean westernization anymore, and the power has gone, and the willingness to accept the power has gone.
The British ran India, we're reminded, with fewer people than administer the welfare department in the city of New York. I mean, it's kind of fantastic what, you know, in today's terms, India put up with.
Well, that's exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
Once the Indians stopped accepting the fact that the British Raj, the British domination, was as legitimate as any other conqueror that had ever been there and established their power, that was the end of the British Empire.
Hmm. In that sense, has the Iraq adventure, misadventure, moved the center of the world, and has it changed the agenda of the new century?
Well, it has in the sense that it makes the enormous military force and the enormous military technological superiority of the United States unprecedented and really unlikely to be equaled by anybody within the reasonable future. It makes this irrelevant because it doesn't really help. What can you do? You could, if need be, capture another lots of Baghdads. What would happen then? We know what happened when we captured Baghdad. We know what happened after we captured Kabul. Several years after that, 30% of Afghanistan is under sort of vague control of somebody who came in then by us, and the rest is not under control. So what's the use of having this particular superiority? You cannot do it without a political base.
Does the rise of China and does the rising wealth and numbers of an expanding Europe fill the gap?
Europe doesn't fill the gap. Europe, I think, is a declining power, demographically declining.
Except that it keeps picking up countries to the east.
Well, I meant Europe in the broad sense. Europe belongs, as indeed does the United States and indeed China, to the part of the world which no longer actually reproduces itself demographically and therefore relies very largely on immigration. Europe has some immigration. The Chinese discourage it. Anybody in East Asia tends to discourage it very much. But basically speaking, Europe is no longer, I mean, it has enormous assets. And it is an economy which is as big as the United States. Actually, at this very moment, the average British income share for the GDP per person is higher than the United States, which was last the case, I think, in 1890. But the fact is, Europe is itself, apart from being a large cultural and, above all, economic unit, is not a major international political and military unit. The United States is a... it relies, I think, on the one thing which it is unique for the United States, namely its military power, but that's the one which is limited. There's not very much you can do with it short of bombing the world to bits. And there's no sense in that. And in fact, once a sensible American government comes back, they will get back to the position of, say, J.F. Kennedy, who knew right from the beginning that bombing the world to bits, it was no solution for anything.
Eric Hobsbawm, I want to ask you about two other historians, one living, one dead. Here's the dead one, Arnold Toynbee. This was 1947, 60 years ago. He wrote in a book called, in a piece called The Unification of the World, he wrote, "The paradox of our generation is that all the world has now profited by an education which the West has provided, except the West itself. The West today is still looking at history from the old parochial, self-centered standpoint which the other living societies have by now been compelled to transcend. Yet sooner or later, the West, in her turn, is bound to receive the re-education which the other civilizations have obtained already from the unification of the world by Western action. I just stumbled upon that, but it seemed rather prophetic, specifically applied now to the United States and its notion of its being an exception to all the old rules.
Well, it certainly applies in the sense that nowadays the idea that the third world is a technologically backward world is no longer the case. I mean, we can see, I said it in my new little book, that, I mean, the United States has research, establishes its research units in China. Software people rely on the training from India, and so on. So to that extent, this is true. I think the enormous rise of China, the other Far Eastern countries, and in due course India will undoubtedly shift the balance, including the educational balance. The accumulated cultural capital of the West, particularly in the universities and research things, is so great that it'll be a long time before Western scholars migrate to universities and research institutes in China, and we don't have a vast brain drain from the poorer countries to the West, and particularly to England and America.
You note in the book, though, that higher education is still a Western idea and a Western practice.
Well, that's going to stop very soon. I mean, the point is, it's still the case that overwhelmingly the people of the higher education are in the West. It's exactly what I meant when I said the accumulation of cultural capital in Western countries. Education will spread. I mean, you could see what's happening in China, and if you consider that the Chinese under Mao, for practical purposes, destroyed their higher education for about 10, 12 years totally. And the advance that they've done since then is extraordinary. I mean, I know the Chinese are very smart, but I mean, it needs to be more than native smartness to catch up that quickly.
More being organized education, you mean?
Organized education, organized sending people for training, bringing them back, establishing their own institutions, and so on.
Toynbee was speaking also, though, about the West's breaking its own provincial sense of itself as an unchangeable, unchanged agent.
Well, I think they're gradually learning that this isn't the case. The one thing that still survives, and that's a dangerous one, is the assumption that somehow or other we know better. We've got the best way of organizing things, and other people should be organized like us. And that if they don't, and if we've got the power, we should intervene to stop them or change them. Now, I can see why we have this, and I see in some instances it is obviously quite right. I mean, take the case of women. Yes? There's no question about it that the difference in the position of women, one of the great revolutions of the 20th century, so far it's been very largely a Western revolution. Nevertheless, the fact is, even the emancipation of women cannot be achieved simply by intervening with military or other force somewhere else. You may think you know better, you may actually know better, but that doesn't mean that the right to intervene on behalf is going to work. And alas, that is one of the problems. It's one of the problems in places like Afghanistan and in places like Iraq, where actually the position of the women has regressed, thanks to, unintendedly regressed, thanks to Western intervention.
The other historian I wanted to ask you about is Neil Ferguson. He's an imperialist. You're an anti-imperialist. He said explicitly in a book on empire that it was our turn, the United States, at running the world, to be successors to the British Empire, in effect to teach and enforce the laws of civilization. You're complete opposites and different generations, of course, and yet you seem to be friends in a sort of ping-pong match about history itself. What's that story?
Well, he's a bright man. There's no question about it. There has been a development of right-wing historians since the days of Thatcher in these countries, of which most are not very good, but Neil Ferguson is very good. For one thing, I have some sympathy with him because he is a trained economic historian and he therefore knows a bit about, you might say, the anatomy of the world.
Yeah? Cash flow.
The cash flow and all that kind of stuff. But the fact is we disagree because precisely I disagree on the idea that our values must be imposed. But I will say he's a good enough historian to believe that while he would wish the United States to become a world hegemonic empire, he doesn't actually think it's going to come about. Although I'm told that he's an advisor to McCain.
Strange part is he knows all the reasons why we're not very good at it. We yeah. don't love travel the way the Brits did. We are a nation born in a revolution against the empire. I pointed out to him that his book on empire had the American edition, the first one, had a picture of British gunships firing incendiary bombs into my town, Boston, Charlestown, to be precise. Mm. He said, "Well, you're the Redcoats now."
That's right. There's a difficult question, of course, because you might say professionals respect each other, even if they disagree. If you think the guy is reasonable, and he is a good enough historian to know that what he wants isn't what really is there.
He's an exciting writer, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, I like him. I get on quite well with him.
And he with you.
Yeah, I mean, but that's neither here. But that comes a different thing, you see. We come from Great Britain, where on the whole, it's a fairly tight intellectual community. And a lot of people know each other and know people who know each other to a greater extent than I think in the United States. That doesn't mean that we have the slightest hesitation in opposing one another bitterly and arguing with one another bitterly, as we have done and will do.
I'm fascinated in the offshore view of the United States. You know our country well. You taught in New York many years. You've written about maybe our biggest cultural contribution, jazz. What's happening to the United States?
I wish I could understand. You see, that's where I really would like to learn from people in the United States. I got a feeling that one of the things that's been happening is a curious division between those bits of America which are part of the modern globalized world and benefit by it, along the coasts like maybe, and large stretches in the middle, which belong to an older phase of industrialization, an older phase of agriculture, and where, in fact, the people that live there no longer know where they stand. The American dream has stopped. Things are not as good as they used to be, or they're only as good because everybody works all the time, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the difference between the old red states and the blue states in the... Why the political effects of this puzzle me. What puzzles me, for instance, is that even in the present Democratic primary election, straightforward fighting for the poor against the rich plays a relatively small role. You know, the one man who stood for it, I think, had to drop out because he didn't get enough support.
John Edwards.
Nevertheless, I think it's a curious business. People have identified, for instance, evangelical fundamentalism with the ultra-right. Well, it certainly has become identified with the ultra-right. But I remember the days when Bible bashers were Rooseveltian Democrats, were union men in West Virginia, were in places like Oklahoma, socialists in the days. It's perfectly possible to be a Bible basher and not necessarily support Bush policy, but it's not at the moment terribly likely thing to happen again.
You became a Latin Americanist over the years. It's a fascinating moment. Fidel Castro leaving the stage and a much broader base of economic anger rising in Latin America. Do you have a general view of what's coming and going there?
Well, not much is coming in Mexico, which I think has taken the wrong line, namely becoming a dependency or allowing itself to be integrated in the U.S. economy. I think a lot is happening in South America, particularly in and around Brazil, for various reasons. Globalization benefits it enormously and other things. I think there's no question about it that the hegemony, the intellectual hegemony and the political hegemony of the United States over the Western Hemisphere is going or has gone, and certainly in South America. I mean, the time when the United States could absolutely control and get unanimous support from the Organization of American States is a long way past. I have considerable hopes, though, of South America. Though it's not clear exactly which way it's going to go. I don't believe it's going to go the Chavez way, even though Chavez has had an enormous effect as being, as it were, a symbol of anti-US, as it were, to take the torch over from Castro as that. And there's no doubt about it. But I don't think he's got the model for it. I'm inclined to think that with all the criticisms about it, the new South America, if at all, will develop around Brazil, which is an enormously flourishing country, and of course a country of absolutely ravishing people, very nice people.
Last question. I'd love to know your general view of the internet transformation, specifically as a architectural device for a very, very different kind of social and political exchange. Is it the kind of thing that can turn the world?
Well, in the sense that it is now possible, as it were, it gives voice to the people that have no voices.
Yes.
Yes? And it gives a transnational voice to these people.
Yes.
This is completely new, novel. Organization, grassroots organization, grassroots discussion is now possible, and to the extent grassroots action, I mean, for instance, in the United States, campaigning by various people, both on the Obama finance and by people like Avars and the others, it's been very effective, and it's not merely in the United States, it is global.
Yes.
That's new. This is the first form through which, as it were, politics can become global.
Yes.
On the other hand, there is the danger that it'll break up into millions of little different conventicles of people sharing each other's views.
Mm. Huh?
and being, as it were, private communities, also private international communities of one kind or another, which won't bother the people with power all that much. Although they will be of considerable interest to the people who want to advertise things. Yeah? And finally, of course, there is the downside of it. The enormous quantity of pure meaningless noise which comes through it, you see. In other words, how to select what is valid in this huge inundation of sounds and opinions is going to be difficult. On the other hand, governments have to some extent lost control, if you like, of public opinion to a greater extent than it did before, because there is no basic infrastructure necessary for those things. They haven't lost control altogether. The Chinese have showed, and for that matter, I'm fairly certain that if anything very serious happened, the United States would be able to have technical means of interfering with the actual internet too.
Of commandeering opinion, in a sense?
Hmm?
Do you mean to say a power of commandeering opinion?
No, not the power of commandeering opinion. The power, in the West, it's very unlikely, although it's not impossible, that you actually put pressure on the servers and the engines in order to exclude certain types of broadcasting on the net, as, for instance, certain types of pornographic. I mean, that's a... and China is trying to do this in a much broader sense, and not ineffectively, because the bigger the service, this is trouble. All this huge democratic potential thing rests, as it were, very largely still on large basic engines.
Mm. What? Yes. I guess I'm wondering if you think that the internet as a new and global trick is somehow up to the global challenge of all these other problems.
No, because the decisions will have to be taken, and nobody on the internet can take the decisions. You can discuss it, you can put it forward, but the decisions will have to be taken. Ideally, they should be taken internationally, globally. That is not likely because there are no global organizations. They would have to be taken by individual states or a consortium of big states acting together, and that, I think, is the best chance that we have, because, unfortunately, whatever globalization has achieved enormously, it has not made any impact on politics so
far.
Yes.
It's the paradox of your book. It's the paradox of our time. Eric Hobsbawm, it's a huge pleasure to talk with you here in London for Open Source. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and it's a pleasure to meet and to be able to talk to Americans who one hopes would be sympathized with some of the things that I say.
Thank you.